Session number 27075, Reel 32.
Squadron Leader Leggett, Reel 32.
32, well that's appropriate.
Could you tell me a little bit about, there's one thing that's interesting me about, obviously you're flying the Vampire. Having really had a staff job for 3 years.
Yeah.
How had you personally kept your hand in with aircraft flying?
Yes, well...
So what did you have to do?
Well, we had... out of Bollingdon, which was... Bollingdon, where is it near? Oh, it's sort of northwest of where we were, northwest of Watford. And we had a communications squadron there. And they had a collection of various types of aircraft, ranging from Anson to the latest Mark Spitfires, with everything else in between. And the idea was that we, on sunny days, when there wasn't too much bad weather about, would ring up and book an aeroplane and tootle out and have an hour or two flying. And that way we kept our flying practice in.
Would you have to keep up a certain number of hours?
Yes, we did. I think it was only 22 hours or something like that, which isn't very much. On the other hand, when you're doing a staff job, there was always a jolly good reason why you couldn't go flying that day, because you got this part in the in tray. But no, it meant at least that we could go probably once or twice a month. Yeah, about every other fortnight it would work out, something like that.
Would you get a chance to practice on jet aircraft at all?
Oh, yes. Yes, I used to fly a Vampire at Bovingdon. And we had a Meteor. I don't know if we had a Meteor 7, but we did have a Meteor, which were the only two in those days. The Hunters were coming along, of course. But it was still just Vampires and Meteors, with some of the later Mark Spitfires. And I think there's a Fury there as well.
Could you describe to me, actually, about the Vampire? Because obviously the Vampire being the sort of second generation of jet fighters after the Meteor, what was it like to fly? And can you give me the characteristics of it as a jet?
Yes. Well... First of all, the most noticeable thing was what a tiny aeroplane it is when you walk out to it and climb in after flying a Meteor, which is a big aeroplane, bigger than anything any fighter had before. And then we find ourselves beside this tiny little thing, pretty, nicely designed, with its twin booms. You step up into the cockpit and sit down. The first thing that impresses you is the magnificent all-round vision. There's nothing in front of you, no engines or propellers or anything in front. You're sitting right up there in the nose, as indeed we were in the Meteors. But you did have this wonderful visibility. It was a simple enough cockpit. It not really very different from a Spitfire cockpit, quite similar in many ways. The primary difference, of course, being the fact that instead of having fuel cocks, you had levers which started up pumps, so that you could pump fuel around the aircraft. They were down beside the seat. You had your standard instrument flying panel, you had your engine instruments over there, you had your throttle lever, undercarriage controls, flap controls. Very, very similar to a Spitfire cockpit, really. But it was nice. The canopy was good. We always flew the canopies closed, of course. And what was comforting was the fact that in your seat, underneath your seat, were four 20mm cannon. These grouped as they were, together, just under the pilot's seat. These were going to give a real punch to anything that happened to get in the way, and this was a nice thought. In those days, our relations with the Russians weren't all that good, and one couldn't help thinking what an exciting moment it would be if you happened to find yourself behind a Rasky who was up to no good, and you've got these four cannons to poop off at him. But I think the fact is, in those days, our job was to be operational at a moment's notice. It was the day-to-day peacetime activities that really ruled our lives. Bearing in mind, in particular, the exhibition side of it, and the fact that 32 and 73 Squadron were the only squadrons to have this equipment, apart from one or two UK-based squadrons. I think, I forget their numbers, but there were one or two Vampire squadrons in the UK. And indeed, they went on to have Venoms in Germany later on. But we did the aerobatic team, in fact, stole a march. Well, no, we were the second runners, that's right. Bobby Oxpring took his squadron from UK to America and back. They went via Newfoundland, Anchorage, I think they went to. So that was a big first for Bobby and his boys. But I think we counted ourselves as second runners for exhibition flying. But of course, these were early days, and really one can say I think it's fair enough to say, these were the beginnings of the Red Arrows, and look at them today. The things they do are just out of this world, and people come from all over the world to see it. They're quite fantastic. There's this wonderful display the other day in France, where the Red Arrows flew up the Champs-Élysées with their red, white, and blue smoke going, and made the French flag as they flew over. Absolutely wonderful flying.
At that time, did you name your aerobatics team?
Did I?
Did the aerobatics team have a name?
No, we didn't think of names, no. That was something that I think the Hunter, when they had Hunters, I think they called themselves. I'm not sure they were the Red Arrows in those days.
I think there were a number of teams prior to
there were by then, yeah. Weren't there? Yes, and the Americans, of course, they were getting their teams all worked up, and the French. In fact, in a few years, with the succeeding few years, were aerobatic teams all over the world, and indeed there are to this day.
Could I ask about the Vampire, actually? Was there an ejector seat in the Vampire?
No, didn't get round to that. No, it was a very basic aeroplane, really. It was a de Havilland Ghost engine. I think it only had about 5,000 pounds thrust, if that. I think it was less than 5,000 pounds. When you think of 75,000 pounds thrust, which some aeroplanes have. But no, it was quite basic. It had an engine, a cockpit, four cannon, a fuel load, and really that was about it.
Did the engine make a distinctive sound?
Yes, it was certainly very different to what we'd been used to. Yes, I think it was a whistling noise, I think. I think it was a whistling noise. It was a nice, it was a lovely toy, really. But that's not to say it could put up a very good show and a scrap, I'm sure. In fact, I brought the squadron home once from Cyprus. We all came home to Odeon for a UK defence exercise. And on one or two occasions, we were put up to intercept incoming raid, which turned out to be quite large formations of B-29s. And this was very exciting. These blooming great aeroplanes, I mean, they are huge. And they would be flying in pretty tight formation, and streams of them. And we were being, we'd only got a few squadrons dotted around the UK for this exercise, but we were put up to intercept. And it really was. One was spoiled for targets. You'd suddenly see the sky full of these massive aeroplanes, and there'd be 12 of us clustered together. And the question was, well, who do we shoot at first? And we often wonder what the comments would be up inside these big things, and they saw us getting in position to make an attack. And of course, you could see all these wonderful remote-controlled guns whizzing around and pointing in all directions.
Would that have been your main fighter interception role? Would it have been potentially Russian bombers at that period?
Yes. We did quite a lot of ground attack. We did quite a lot of rocket firing. But that was just that it was part of the program. Yes, our target, if it had come, undoubtedly it would have been Russian bombers. I don't think Cyprus itself was regarded as a particular target. One can only guess, of course, but the canal zone, of course, that was the real target. I never quite knew why it was that the only two jet squadrons in the Middle East were on islands in the Mediterranean, when surely the primary target for an attack by anybody, whether it's the Russians or the Israelis or whoever, should not have the first jet squadrons. They still clung on to their Furies and things, which is a bit strange.
Could it have possibly been that they were worried that a loss of a jet fighter over maybe Israeli territory would give away secrets or something of that order?
Could be, yes. Yes, that could be the case. But, who knows what was in the official mind.
How do you think...
It suited us jolly well. I'd far sooner be in Cyprus than the canal zone. In fact, well, the time did come. I was there for 3 years. I think after 2 years in Cyprus, there were mutterings going on. And the CNC came up one day and was muttering to the station commander. And it transpired that they were muttering about the probability of moving 32 Squadron from Cyprus to the canal zone. And this, in fact, did come to a head. And I had a groan to the AOC in Cyprus. Couldn't understand why they wanted to move us out. We were doing a very good job here in Cyprus. It was a huge morale booster. And undoubtedly, it must have been having some influence on the situation between the Greeks and the Turks. The attack, the Royal Air Force were there, and they weren't going to stand any nonsense.
I imagine the jets would have made quite an impression.
Oh,
that
sure.
Period.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I mean, when they first appeared, apparently the local people ran for shelter. But I did have a go at the AOC, but he said, "Well, I'm afraid it looks like it's been decided. You'll have to go." And indeed, we went. But of all things, we were shuffled off down to a place called Shalufa. The canal zone is a string of airfields, half a dozen of them. And Shalufa is the most southerly of them. Well, as you probably know, the canal zone basically comprises two large lakes connected by canals. Well, most of the squadrons, most of the airfields were dotted around these lakes. So life for them was quite pleasant. They could have gardens and they could have swimming and sailing and so on. But once you passed the little bit of lake and went further south down towards Suez, you just got a stretch of canal, which was interesting enough, and there were ships going and coming and going all the time. But the swimming wasn't very agreeable. The water wasn't all that clean. And we did have a swimming pool, but it wasn't anything like the delightful setup some of the stations had up beside the lakes. And so there we were at Shalufa, sitting on the sand in a rather tatty camp. But that was the job. And it was primarily one of carrying out air exercises. Now, here we did do quite a lot with the army. We had several wars down various parts of the desert. And, there'd be tank battles going on, and we'd carry out rocket attacks on all sorts of things. So it had its excitement. There was nothing to prevent us getting into a car if we wanted to swim. It did mean driving 20 miles down to the sea, but it could be done.
What was the system of ground control at this stage?
Very basic. Yeah, very basic. Astonishingly enough, there was none in Cyprus. There was no radar in Cyprus. There was in Malta, of course. But there was no radar in Cyprus, and indeed, there wasn't even a VHF Homer when I went there. And I said one day to the AOC, I said, we've got a blooming great 6,000-foot mountain here. We must be able to man the most efficient homing device in the world on top of that mountain. He said, yes, we could, couldn't we? And astonishingly enough, not long afterwards, they installed a Homer on top of Trudos Mountain. And people from all over the place said, well, why didn't they do this before? We use that Homer a lot now. So that was one of those strange things.
How would you, obviously you mentioned little wars you were having out in the desert, but I take it that was obviously in the ground attack role. How would you identify targets there?
How would identify?
You identify?
How did we? I think, yes, we dropped back to the old bomb line principle, as we had in the desert. The army liaison officer, every morning we'd have a briefing, and he'd bring all his maps and pin them all up. And there would be this stretch of Sinai Desert and so on, and he'd stick pins in here and there, and then he'd draw the bomb line and say, right, everything this side is ours, everything the other side is them, you can shoot at it. And I think that's the way it worked primarily.
Would there be any ground-to-air communication at all?
Oh, yes. We in the canal zone, there was radar, and we did have a proper ground controller. Yeah. Not terribly efficient, but it was there, and it worked to a certain extent. But, of course, in those weather conditions, interception wasn't all that difficult. You could see things miles away. If you were sent out to attack a pinpoint target on the ground, it was never all that difficult to find it. One of the things we used to do, Shalufa was used by Bomber Command, UK Bomber Command, for rotation of bomber squadrons to operate in subtropical conditions. And these, most squadrons were Lincolns at that time. And these Lincoln squadrons would arrive, and they'd spend a fortnight with us. That was rather nice. We always had company. And then they would go off with some target. Very often the target was Habaniya in Iraq. And they would operate from Shalufa. And before we went to Sulu for full time, we would operate from Cyprus on an interception of these Lincolns coming in from the canal zone. So that was quite a good exercise, except the absence of radar made a nonsense of it, of course, because the wing commander flying would set himself up with an operations room in his office, and he'd have a plotting board set up, and the bomber aircraft, as they went round their tour from Shalufa down to wherever they were going, back up into Iraq, and then more or less due west to Cyprus where they were going to land, and they would pass their position by radio through to our wing commander flying, who would then stick a pin in the board or put a plot on the table, and then this would be transferred to us in the air, and we'd go to make the interception. And as I say, the visibility was so good, you could nearly always spot a Lincoln a long way off, and so we'd have a lot of fun attacking them.
Could you take me through how you would organise, say, an interception exercise from the start of the day through to the interception and your role as squadron commander in that?
Well, on these exercises, we generally operated in pairs. The Lincolns also were operating singly and spread out with at least half an hour, I think, between, or a quarter of an hour anyway, between each aircraft. So it was small numbers, really. We weren't operating on a squadron strength basis in those exercises. So we'd operate at pairs. And it would simply be a case of assuming we're still in Cyprus and the Winko's up there with his table. And he would get... He'd be watching the Lincolns coming across on his plot. And at the right moment, he'd scramble one pair, and off we'd go. He would then give us a course to steer from base, and we'd set off usually, nearly always eastwards, out towards where the Lincoln would be coming in. I think in those days, I can't remember whether they were overflying Israel or not. I think probably they had to skirt round. I must confess, I'm not too sure what happened after they'd done their bombing run on Habaneer, but could well be that in those days we had at least got relations with Turkey and were overflying. Anyway, they would be coming in more or less from the due east. And Deacon Elliot would simply give us courses to steer, and we nearly always see the bomber. They were always flying about 10 or 12,000 feet, and we'd be at about 8, and you could see the things up there. It was always first light that'd come in, so it was all a bit unrealistic. On the other hand, it did give us an operational feel about it, the fact that we were hunting an enemy aircraft, so to speak, and that they were going to be a target for us to practice our attacks on. So it was all to the good, and it all worked quite well. And we'd all have a jolly good party in the mess that evening.
How would you practice your attacks on the bomber coming in? Would there be any changes again from what your Second World War experience?
No, much the same. We had long since discarded, thank goodness, the old fighter attacks numbers 1, 2, and 3, blessed in memory. And indeed, each pilot was left to make his attacks the way he preferred to do it. I personally used to like to come in from a fairly high angle, come down on the tail of the attacking aircraft, swing round with it, and then carry on firing till I was inverted, and then fall out of the bottom way. The point being, of course, that once you've made an attack on the bomber, the last thing you must do is pull up over the top of him, because that's when the gunner gets you. So you always dive away downwards. And I used to go into a complete roll and dive away like that. So that was life in Shalufa.
Can I just ask what type of range the Vampire had?
Range of a Vampire. Yeah, it's about 800 miles, I think, as far as I can recall. I could go comfortably. Yes, I flew comfortably from Istres, which is Marseille. This is when we came home to the exercise at Odeon. From Istres to Odeon is about 600, I think. So it had been about 800 miles. Yeah. We had overload tanks, and they gave us another couple of hundred. Yeah. So it was a reasonable range. Yeah.
And at that time, had you had any knowledge of say the Russian jets that have been introduced to the Korean War time?
Not a lot. No, we did have. I did have at Chalufa. A reading room in the pilot's crew room, and we would get all the intelligence summaries, and quite a lot of literature used to come through, so this was always available in the reading room, and I used to encourage the pilots to go through this stuff. They might not read everything, but certainly do a bit of reading up. We would never know just how soon we were going to need to know it in earnest.
Sounds like there's a big change in ethos again from your experience of training as a pilot and early squadron experience to that point. Although it is peacetime, it seems very much like you were encouraging people to be ready.
Oh, indeed. Oh, yes. We had to feel that. The lid could blow off things at any time. It wasn't a good idea to discard the whole idea that we might suddenly become operational. It always had to be in the forefront of our minds, and anything we did had to be geared towards the possibility of becoming operational at a moment's notice. And of course, this was the purpose of these exercises. And indeed, we did exercises at Chalufa itself, and we set the whole thing up on a war footing. And instead of being in the crew room with all the comforts of home, when they weren't in the air, I put two caravans, a control caravan and an ops caravan, on the end of the runway, and a tent, and that was the setup. And we had everything sitting on the end of the runway. So that when we got a scramble, it was into cockpits. Well, sometimes we'd have to do cockpit standby, and that was jolly hot sitting out back there. We had to have shades put over the top, bamboo shades. But yes, those exercises were useful, and we used to pretend we were on a war footing.
Because in many respects, that sounds very similar to what you did in Malta. But I imagine many of the younger pilots had no experience of that.
Oh, yes, indeed. Oh, yes. They must have found it all very exciting. It was a new world to them, of course. Going into large-scale exercise, particularly against the American 6th Fleet, that was really something, because they would come over in droves, wave upon wave of them, all sorts of things. They have Sky Raiders and... Well, they had their first jets, whatever they were called. All sorts of different types, all the various fighters, the Grumman Wildcats and all those, U.S. Navy. And there would be wave upon wave of them, so it was really exciting for the boys to get stuck into this lot. But, of course, the big excitement came when I was sent for by the AOC. He said, "We've got to face the possibility of the Mediterranean being closed, as it was in the last war."